Okay, so just to recap, some sections in Mark so far. If you were to divide it in half, somewhere in the middle, what happens in the middle? Peter says you're the Christ, and who else says something?
Transfiguration.
And the Transfiguration. So Peter says you're the Christ, God says this is my son. So right at the beginning, right in the middle, and right at the end, the main idea, Jesus is God's king. If you were to divide the first section up further without looking over there, what might you do? About 34, 35, yeah. And then what's the difference between before that and after that? They start crossing the sea. This, how many times? Three times. Before that, it's, remember, Jesus public but opposed. After that, he withdraws. He's with his disciples on the move, yeah. And then you get, so three sea crossings, then you get Peter's confession. Then what's the next thing that happens three times? Three predictions of his death, which takes you from chapter 8 all the way through to the end of chapter 10. And just to help you know, that's a section, something at the beginning and the end of that. Blind men get healed, brilliant. Then three something else. Three visits to the temple. Yeah, that takes you from chapter 11 to chapter 13. And then Jesus dies. And we've seen, as we've been looking at each of those sections, these three themes of king, rescuer and judge. And what I thought I'd do is to very quickly take you through some of the themes. So, what do we learn in the first section about Jesus as king? Well, we glimpse Jesus' authority, his kingly authority, over things like demons. He does exorcisms, he heals people from sicknesses. He even raises a little girl from the dead. It's Jesus' authority, but it's more than just kind of his authority, as in he's powerful, otherwise he couldn't do this. It's more than that. It's a kingly authority. It's a, let me give you a glimpse of what the kingdom is like. If Jesus is the king and he's bringing in the kingdom, then when you encounter Jesus, you see who he is. You also see what his reign is going to be like. And so he banishes demons because his kingdom has no evil in it, and he cures sickness because in his kingdom there's no diseases and no one ever dies. And so you're glimpsing not just his power as in here's a party trick that you couldn't do, you're seeing his power as in you're glimpsing a kind of world that you want, that he will bring about, his kingdom world. He gets the messianic title, the Son of Man, a couple of times. From Daniel chapter 7. The demons identify him as the Holy One of God. They know who he is. Right from the beginning, there's this conflict of his kingdom versus the kingdom of the power of the king of the power of the air. There's this kind of conflict between Jesus' kingdom and the illegitimate power of Satan. But Jesus rejected as king. What about that first section about Jesus' rescue? Well, it's in that section that he reveals that he has authority on earth to forgive sins, and that he says that he has come not to be a doctor for the healthy but for sinners. What about his judgment? Who's been before you to tell us about how God's judgment is experienced in the first section of Mark, particularly in the parables? David, how are the parables of judgment?
So those who don't receive in chapter 4 with the parable of the sower, those who don't listen are prevented from responding.
Yeah, so what's the point of parables? Little stories to make it easy to understand what Jesus is talking about?
They're deliberately difficult to understand.
Yeah.
So that people are judged in not understanding.
Brilliant. So to start with, Jesus' teaching is very public and open. And then the more he gets rejected, he says, I'm going to switch to another kind of teaching now that you won't be able to understand. And it's a kind of judgment in that knowledge about God is no longer free for everyone. It's only for those who come to Jesus to ask what it means. For other, everyone else is mystified. It's just a little story about someone farming. It means nothing to them. So that's the beginning of his judgment, yeah. Then we get this kind of sea crossing bit. Jesus starts crossing the sea, and he's revealed as king because, again, he can do all these amazing kingdom-like things. He drives the demons out of the pigs. He raises Jairus' daughter from the dead. He cures a woman with a hemorrhage. All these kind of kingly things. And then he makes kingly provision, like a great banquet, as he feeds 5,000 people. And then he feeds 4,000 people. So that's 9,000 people, and that's only the men. So you've got, you know, a lot of thousands of people at this banqueting of the king. But also, the feeding of the 5,000, feeding of the 4,000 is a kind of a bit of a rescue thing. Because there's lots and lots of overtones of the Exodus and the manna from heaven that God provided. And of course, that wasn't only provision, it was a dramatic rescue, the biggest ever rescue in the Old Testament. And so Jesus is glimpsed as the rescuer king. And he's the rescuer. He's come not just for the Jews, but then he moves into Gentile territory and starts doing miracles there as well. The universal rescuer. And he's the judge. It's in that section of Mark with this, that he begins to teach about human hearts and where the problem with the Pharisees really lies. It's not just that they've got their rituals wrong, it's that their hearts are the source of evil thoughts, immorality, and so on. And then there's his confession. Again, those three themes, king, rescuer, judge, come together. And what about after that? Jesus the king. Well, now the title Son of Man is used again and again and again. The kingly title of the king. But what really comes to focus in this three times predictions of his death is Jesus' work to rescue his people. We realise that people cannot save themselves. Even the rich young man with all of his promise, who's kept all the commandments since he was a boy, even he can't get in to the kingdom by himself. And finally, at the climax of this section, Jesus explains that he has come to give his life as a ransom for many. So really at the heart of that section is the theme of God's rescue. At the heart of the next section, the temple, is the theme of judgment. So you may know that it begins with Jesus walking past a fig tree and cursing it. And it's just, you know, liberal commentators have a field day about this because they say, look, Jesus has lost his temper. He's not sinless after all. He has a bad hair day. He's being totally unreasonable because it's not even the season for figs. It's like going into an orchard, you know, in the middle of a winter and then getting cross that there's no apples in it. I mean, come on, he must know better than that. It's just an irrational outburst of rage. Because it's not that at all. Jesus curses a fig tree, then he walks into the temple and he sees that, like the fig tree, it's similarly fruitless. It's bearing no fruit of righteousness, and he clears it out and throws out all the traders in the temple. And then he goes out the temple and they see that the fig tree has withered. It's almost like an enacted parable. One of you listed it as one of your parables earlier. It's as if Jesus is saying, it's going to be like this fig tree for you, the temple. It's over for you. You're bearing no fruit and you're good for nothing but to be judged and ended. That's at the beginning of that section. The middle of that section is the parable of the tenants we've already looked at. Jesus pronounces God's judgment on those who kill the son. What will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and destroy those tenants and give the vineyard to others. It's his judgment. And then at the end of that section, Jesus goes round the temple in chapter 13 and he gives an extended sermon on the judgment that is to come on the temple and on the whole world at the end of the age. So that section begins to focus particularly on God's judgment. And then as we go back to Jesus' death, the focus again is now on his rescue. And there's a whole load of themes that come together to teach us that Jesus will be will make a penal substitution for his people. He will bear God's punishment in place of the people. So for example, at the Last Supper, while they're eating the Passover meal, the annual Passover meal, where they celebrate what? Who can tell me the background of the Passover? What are they celebrating every year?
Rescue from Egypt and from judgment.
Brilliant. Yep, so it's God's great deliverance in the days of the Exodus from the Egyptians. But why have food and why have a lamb and... Brilliant. Yeah, so the plague, the final of the 10 plagues in Exodus, the plague on the firstborn son. God's judgment came at midnight, and every house the firstborn son died in every single household in Egypt, unless you had killed a lamb instead and put the blood on the doorpost of your house. And if the lamb had been killed, then the eldest son didn't die. And so they celebrate this every year. It's the most important festival in the Jewish calendar. And here they are, Jesus having his annual Passover meal with his disciples, and they're halfway through munching on it, and he suddenly goes, that's my body. And you can almost imagine the kind of the food sticking in there on their fork and almost spitting it out or something. It must have been a shocking thing to say. And then they're drinking some of the wine and they're halfway down their throat, that's my blood. It's just a graphic, strange thing to say. But Jesus says, I am like the lamb in the Old Testament, that you kill the lamb and your son doesn't die. I'm the swap sacrifice. It's there at the Passover. It's there in Gethsemane. You remember Jesus. So I think it's an amazing contrast. The Jesus who is Mr. In Control throughout the Gospel. The Jesus who is never fazed by any danger. So here they are on a storm in chapter 4, and the waves are breaking over the boat. Everyone's terrified that they're going to die. And Jesus, he's asleep. And they wake him up and he says, what's all the fuss about? Why are you worried? Shh, quiet. It's calm. Mr. In Control. Suddenly, Mr. In Control is out of control. I think it's so moving. You look at Gethsemane and Jesus is basically falling apart. And you think, this is not a guy who is easily stressed. It's not someone who's easily thrown by circumstances. And he really can't hold it together. And he's in tears and he's begging his disciples to help him and to somehow support him, and they can't. And then he cries out to his father, Father, if possible, take this cup from me. And what does he mean? He means in the Old Testament, the cup of God's anger, which he gives to the wicked of the earth to drink down to its very dregs. So Jesus, the one person in the Bible that you would not expect to face the cup of God's judgment, goes willingly to drink it in order to save. You see it again when he quotes from Zechariah and says that strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. And you look at the quote and it turns out that Zechariah is saying that God will strike his own anointed king in judgment. God will judge his king. And that is what Jesus came to do. So in that section, again and again, Jesus focuses on the rescue he will bring as he receives punishment on behalf of his people. And then at the crucifixion, it all comes together again. Jesus the king, and he's the rescuer, and he's the judge. And then 3 days later, he rises again. And I think it's interesting, the resurrection in Mark. Mark goes to quite a lot of lengths to convince you that it really happened historically. So, for example, he tells you that the stone across the tomb was really, really big. As if to say, I don't know if there's any... He doesn't want you to think that somehow, you know, someone might have nabbed the body or Jesus might have pushed it. He gets the stone, which was very large. And as the women all going to the tomb, they're all saying, well, we want to anoint it with spices, but however will we get in because that stone is so big? So Mark brings that out as a kind of emphasis. He brings out the fact that the witnesses are the same witnesses who saw Jesus die and who saw where he was buried. He names them, all three of them, each time at the crucifixion, at the burial, and on the first day of the week. So there's no question they got the wrong tomb or that Jesus wasn't really dead. These are the same three women who see it. Those kinds of details to say it really, really happened. But almost no theology. There's no separate kind of teaching about the resurrection apart from that it happened. And I wonder if that's because in Mark's gospel, Jesus' death and resurrection kind of come together as a package. So really his resurrection just tells you his death works. Three times he predicts, I'll die, and then 3 days later I'll rise. I'll die, 3 days later I'll rise. I'll die, 3 days later I'll rise. And it happens, like he says. And just turn, this is interesting, just turn to chapter 16, verse 7. And the one clue to what the resurrection means, I think, is in verse 6 and 7. Look at 6 and 7. Don't be alarmed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has risen. So see again, death and resurrection together. Then verse 7. Go tell his disciples and Peter, he's going before to Galilee. There you'll see him just as he told you. And you're thinking, where did he tell them that? Just turn back to chapter 14, verse 26, 27. It's written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered. After I'm raised up, I'll go before you to Galilee. See, every time you get Jesus' death, you get his resurrection. Every time you get Jesus' resurrection, you get his death. He predicts it three times, and then four times if you include this one, and that's what the angel points them to. The resurrection is a vindication of Jesus' death. That's an overview of Mark, very, very quickly. And because one of our aims today is familiarity, I thought I'd get you to do a crazy exercise. Which is a bit like our test earlier, but you can do this in groups. And what I've done is I've got a load of sentences kind of summarising little incidents in Mark, and they're all in random order, and what I want you to do is to tear them off and try and put them in the right order. And even if you can't get them exactly right in terms of is this before or after that, see if you can get them in the right kind of sections in Mark's Gospel. Okay, that's the plan.